Hey, y'all, I'm Maddie.
And I'm Poodle.
And together, we host the podcast Reality Gaze.
We are two ridiculous homosexuals who love nothing more than talking about reality television
and tearing in a new one.
So whether it's 90 Day Fiancé, Love is Blind, Love After Lockup, or any other trash TV show about lonely hearts looking for love, your gay besties got you covered, y'all.
New shows every week. Follow and listen to Reality Gaze wherever you get your podcast. Reality
Gaze, let's love!
I feel like this is a position to be that is very useful to demystify a lot of things, right? Like growing up, you really don't know where your money is being spent. You really don't know what your government is doing.
Yeah.
And I look at like the people like me when I was growing, you know. Now, you know, I just live in my life. I don't really know what's happening in government. I'm like, well, let me try to target these people. So they know what their government is doing. And that's why we do everything through like funny mediums, right? Of course, we still have our long page reports that are super serious. But if you really want to meet people where they are, you have to explain it to them or do things in a way that that makes sense.
What is up, and welcome to another episode of In a Minute with Evan Lovett, coming to you live from the I Am Studios in the heart of Los Angeles. And here today, we have the watchdog of Los Angeles, if you will, Kenneth Mejia, the Los Angeles City Controller, who it's incredible because I wouldn't even be able to name a previous LA City Controller, but he has somehow been able to take the position, make it high profile, and tell us basically how important it really is. And he's done it in such a unique fashion. This is a really good story, is what I'm trying to say. Like, you hear City Controller accounting, it's one of those, you know, your eyes roll back in your head, but he's made it exciting. And he's really taken a stand and been a face for the city of Los Angeles and a face for transparency in finance for the city of Los Angeles, and has been able to rally up a lot of support for a position that's generally under the radar. So, I mean, we're going to get into his background. First Filipino American elected to citywide office in Los Angeles. That is significant in a city with such a proud and deep Filipino history and big population. But Kenneth, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate this. And thank you for everything you're doing for the city.
Thank you so much, Evan, for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll give you my background with Kenneth Mejia. First of all, again, I never even hear about the city control. You know, I vote and blah, 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 but it's one of those where you're like, account, I knew it as maybe the city account, which probably isn't accurate, you know, but where you're like, okay, does this, it matters, but like, what do they even really do kind of thing? But I started seeing you on social media and I started seeing you just get a high profile based on, you know, you're previously an activist, you'd run for office previously, but you really have strong opinions, right? Based on being a native, you know, from Los Angeles, from the San Fernando Valley, by the way, proud Valley native. And it really was something that brought attention to a position that's important at a time that it's potentially more important than before or than in my lifetime because of fraud and finance and waste, which are issues that are kind of taking over the narrative. So first and foremost, let's do this. Tell me, what does the Los Angeles City Controller do?
Sure. The Los Angeles City Controller is the city's accountant, auditor, and paymaster. What people know me for, though, is mostly the oversight audit work. But that's only like a very small portion of my office. It's actually 10% of my office. But most of it is the accounting work that we do.
Yeah.
And the paymaster work. So city's watchdog is another word, too, as well.
And I think that that's good. And I think that that's important because, you know, especially, I mean, coming out of COVID and, you know, with the new administration and just with the high profile that and polarization that politics has undergone in the last, you know, since really social media came to the forefront, I think it's important. I think a lot of people have more awareness. They might not have the full knowledge, but they have more awareness of, you know, funds may not be going to what we think they are going to, or they're just really, what do these budget, you hear these budget numbers and they're in the millions and they're in the billions and it's almost inconceivable. But you have these great ways of explaining and extrapolating and showcasing where the money really goes. And you do a fantastic, you do fantastic work on social media kind of explaining that. And I think that's really led to a lot of your popularity. Which again, it's kind of funny to say that the city controller is a popular person, but you've shown how important it is and done it with personality and done it by being a legit person, by being yourself. So, I mean, commend you on that, but talk about that. Why that's important for you and been one of your main sort of missions that, that you've been able to accomplish.
Yeah. You know, like you said, when we ran for office, like no one knew about what the controller position was. Right. I would say 9 out of 10 had no idea.
Right. Right.
And the end result was us receiving the most votes ever in the history of Los Angeles elections for city controller. Because of what you were just saying, we made the position, we demystified it. We showed people why it's really important. We showed people why people need to know where the money goes or where it doesn't go and how things could get spent better. And we did that through various mediums, social media, billboards. We had thousands of yard signs throughout Los Angeles.
I remember. We were, absolutely.
You know, banner dropping off the freeway, Pikachu, like 7 Pikachus everywhere.
So smart.
Getting people's attention. So because accounting could be very dry and it could be thousands of pages. Literally, when you read these budget documents, people fall asleep. And luckily I used my skills as an, you know, CPA and auditor. I know what to look for and I know how to, you know, combine with our, you know, campaign manager, Jane's like graphic design skills and tools and everything
we made. Jane the brains and the vision behind all that?
That's what I tell people. Like Jane is the boss. People don't know that, you know, or they do know that because I always say it. But Jane is the boss.
That's, it's some pretty fantastic work. The one I saw recently, which I know you've done varieties of in the past, is just where does the budget money go? And it's a simple graphic.
Right.
But when you see it visualized in this, I don't know if you call it bar graph. I don't, I'm not going to do it justice probably, but you see, you know, the police bars way out here, you know, and then, you know, fire.
You have to swipe to go to the next.
Yeah. So, I mean, it really helps you visualize where those dollars go. And then it kind of goes hand in hand with the fact that, look, you're opinionated. You're an activist. If you look up Kenneth Mejia, you know, activist is a term that continually comes up.
On Wikipedia, yep.
So you obviously have very strong opinions and directions on things like that. Is that one of the reasons why you wanted to get into this position, is to sort of make a difference or to shine a light on issues that are important to you and where money is going and maybe should potentially be directed somewhere else?
Yeah, you know, I would say a lot of the local issues, especially around advocacy or activism work, is shaped by data and like research and numbers. And what I wanted to do is, well, there's so much like fighting, right? Happening from left, right, whatever, middle. And I just wanted to just show what the data shows.
Yeah.
You know, because everyone says, well, we need more money for this, or this is what happens when you increase this or defund this. And I was like, well, let me just show you the numbers to tell you guys the truth. And that's how I lead, right? I don't really say super strong opinions. Now that I'm in office, I just show a bar chart just to show like where the money goes, or a pie chart.
And
how
I think
it's
that's more
up.
Powerful.
Exactly.
I think that's more powerful.
And that's why I think we received a lot of support from the left and right, even people who are, you know, against what, you know, some of the issues that I'm not for, you know, that I'm really strong on, they still agree with me because they love that I'm putting everything out there. And so I think that is, you know, it's a funny joke. Well, not a joke, it's a reality. But last election, we literally have supporters having a Mejia yard sign with a Karen Bass yard sign. And then across the street, it was a Caruso yard sign and a Mejia yard sign. And so you would just see like everyone was on board with the message of transparency and accountability.
I have that in all caps in my notes is where transparency in a city, in a culture, in an era where that's not necessarily the protocol or the way that people operate. But I do think that people nowadays, that's what they want. Even if it's, whether it's, you know, accounting or politics or just a social media figure, they want something genuine. They want something authentic. They want something honest.
Right.
And like, you're able to spell that out. And I'll tell the truth. I'll lay it out here. Initially, when you were campaigning, I was like, oh, come on. Like, we can't be running. This activist is running for controller, like blah, blah, blah. And you know, I was like, are we really going to do this? Blah, blah, blah. But since you've been in office and seeing what you've done and the way that you've been able to explain these things, I'm like, you know what? This is the first time in my life that I've been informed on these issues and that I have this knowledge. And it's helped me kind of understand the city and the budget, these things that, again, you're like, this is so big. How would I ever even begin to kind of understand that? And knowing that your position really is to, you know, you don't, quote unquote, have an impact, like you're changing policy and things like that. But when you explain that data, when you show and when Jane creates this data to you know, simplify it for normal folk, you're like, wow, this really does start to make a lot of sense. And I want to commend you for having an impact in a position that really doesn't necessarily sort of lead that kind of way. So I think that you're almost reinventing that position, and that's a testament to like who you are and what you've been able to accomplish. So, you know, even not seeing eye to eye to politics, which, by the way, I must say, listen, for all of us, and I'm going to go off on a little tangent, we got to have conversations and dialogue with people that we don't agree with 100%. Because guess what? At the end of the day, everybody wants the same things, you know, safety, food on the table, happiness, their kids to have a good, you know, so you can have differences of opinion and still come to the table and still find some common ground. So I just want to say that on the side. But let's talk about your background, how you became the Kenneth Mejia of today. I will say, as a proud Valley native, I was charmed and excited to learn that you are a Valley native as well. Tell us about your childhood and, you know, what made you, you know, who you are today. And there we go.
Sure. You know, so my parents, they're from the Philippines. Yeah. When they first got to Los Angeles, they settled down in historic Filipino town in Westlake. I was actually born in Good Samaritan in Westlake, but then right when I was growing up, we moved to Sylmar.
Yeah.
And so I was raised most of my life in Sylmar,
yeah.
You know, growing up there and, you know, very working class neighborhood. Yeah, exactly.
Filipinos in the San Fernando Valley.
Yeah,
by
thank
the
you,
way.
Joe Bernardo.
Written by my friend. Do you know Joe?
Yeah.
He's cool. Good dude.
Good
great
dude. Yeah, spoke in his class.
Check out the book. Anyway, go on. Sorry.
So, yeah, grew up there, you know, very working class neighborhood, very diverse, predominantly Latino neighborhood. Yeah. You know, I, at a young age, my parents divorced when I was young. So I think that really like shaped a lot of my like upbringing.
Yeah.
So, when I was seven, they split. And so I was raised mostly by my mom. And so just like growing up, you know, in a, you realize like, oh man, I guess life is not like my classmates, right? Like everyone had like their parents and stuff. So, you know, I would like see my dad like every, you know, every 2 weeks or so, but it wasn't like the same,
yeah.
Like Father's Day were different. And so that really like shaped me, to who I am today because I had to grow up faster. I had to rely on help from others or like realizing that my mom had to do a lot, like physically on her own while being a nurse. And so I think that really shaped me in terms of, okay, no one's gonna like look out for you.
Yeah.
And you know, and as I grew older, I wanted to reach a hand back. And that's what I did, right? Like, you know, I worked hard. I basically every time I moved up, I would see who was there and try to bring people along for me, whether it was like a job, like I got a nice job. I would bring people back to work for that firm. Like I worked at EY, Ernst & Young.
Yeah.
And I brought like three or four more people after that. Cause, you know, I felt like it was tough. It was tough. And same thing when I got into City Hall, I was like, oh, let's bring more people in.
That's
here that
dream,
I came up with.
Man, is to help those that helped you.
Exactly.
And like to uplift those communities that you're familiar in that deserve it. Yeah.
But Sylmar, you know, it's just that working class feel very, you know, used to go to the park a lot, El Carrizo.
Yeah.
My favorite restaurant was Casa Torres, just because my classmate was the son, son of the owners. Shout out Daniel
and Carlos.
A good spot. And even when I campaign there, I'll try to visit there too. But just brings me back, you know, memories and of just how real and you know, is simple a little bit in Sylmar. You know, it's not like. Like in downtown LA, like where I'm at right now in Westlake, where it's just always something happening, but.
Something, it's the Valley, you know, it's part of the charm of being in the Valley. And by the way, my wife's from Sylmar, so great memories.
People don't know Sylmar is part of the city, right?
Exactly. Top of the Valley, the most northern neighborhood in Los Angeles City, in fact. Right. So, and somewhere we could get into the deep history. We were talking off air, but we're not going to spend time on that now. But tell me what kind of student you were.
Troublemaker. Really? I was a trouble.
People good think, trouble, as you know, they say, or
no, bad trouble. Okay. The funny thing is, you know, now people think like I'm a nerd, which is fine. I'll take it. Like, yeah. You know, I wish I was a nerd, but I was a bad kid, getting in trouble, getting sent to the principals, getting written up a lot. Class clown.
Okay,
I would say that. You know, which people could sort of like see that, like, oh, okay, because I make funny videos.
Yeah.
But I was, I worked hard though. You know, I worked hard to.
Obviously intelligent.
Because of my mom. Because like I would see her work hard and I would screw up so much. And then like I would just see how, you know, that affected her. Right. And so that's why I said like I had to like really, I tried to have a life of being a little kid and screwing around, but I realized I couldn't keep doing that.
Yeah.
And I had to learn that at, like at the age of like seven, like age of seven, eight, nine. And so. You know, right when I got to, you know, it was actually until I was like way older, like college, though, I started taking stuff seriously. But I was always, I would say more rebellious and things like
but
that.
Yeah. So let's talk about high school, because high school is a very crucial time for many people. Did you want to be an accountant? Did you know, like, at what point in your life were you like, I'm going to go into accounting? Where did that come from?
Yeah. So, no, I didn't. I didn't even know in high school. I didn't even know in college.
Oh.
So when I got into college, I was like majoring in comms marketing.
Okay. I could see.
And, yeah. You know, I was taking all these communication classes and, you know, from then there was an accounting class and I know, you know, my dad is an accountant. And so I was like, oh, okay, well, let me just try an accounting class. And it came really easy to me. And, you know, I'm good at math. And so from there, I was like, you know, I just took accelerated college and I graduated college in 2.5 years.
Wow.
Completely.
Woodbury, right?
Yeah, Woodbury. Shout yeah. Woodbury. A month after I turned 20, graduated. And
what did you think of Woodbury though, real quick?
I mean, Woodbury, super small, chill school.
Yeah.
That's why I said like, you really have to work hard to make yourself known because no one knows about the school.
Right.
Now in the school, they mention me everywhere, which is dope, you know?
That's
like
great.
I said, put me on the map anywhere, you know? Cause I remember everything and I want everyone that I touched or every organization that I touched to go up with me as well. But, you know, very small school, got there on scholarship. So that helped a lot. But that, you know, I didn't really have like a lot of folks who had connections into the big four accounting firms.
Yeah.
Cause that's, you know, that's where you want to go. If you studied accounting, you want to go to EY, Deloitte, KPMG, PwC. Right. And so like, It was one person who gave me a shot at EY and he let me do this externship and his name is Ron. And I'll never forget it because he's the one who he's the reason why I'm here. He gave me a shot at EY. I was like going to internships with like mostly 90% USC, UCLA. Yeah. And I was like the only one from this small school.
How did Ron even find
me? So there was this recruiter at my school who said, hey, Kenneth, there's this like externship. And it was the only big four accounting firm that let our school know. And so I was like, oh, let me just do it. So I went there, worked hard, networked, got a lot of like different offers to work for different areas of the firm. So like I was going to work in tax or advisor, like consulting or an audit. And so I chose audit. But I would just say like, if it wasn't for those people, the recruiter and Ron who gave me a shot, I wouldn't have made it here. And that's sort of how like I see a lot of my life and how I want to change that as I go up is make more opportunities for folks and see that, you know, that even though there was this kid who really wasn't that good in school or he didn't get the best grades back in the day or whatever, but I know he works hard and he's going to get it and people like him and, you know, give that shot. So it's.
Do you have a dark curiosity? Heart Starts Pounding, Horrors, Hauntings, and Mysteries is a weekly podcast hosted by me, Kaylin Moore. Check out Heart Starts Pounding on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Crazy.
Man, yeah. Creating that community, it's more than a network, what you do, and something that I've admired, you know, where it's like, again, I keep throwing that caveat. I mean, as a controller, but I'm just saying as a human, as a politician, as a person, to see, you could sense your loyalty. You could sense your genuineness. And you see that reflected with how loyal people are to you and the passion that they have for what you do. I mean, listen, we've had Karen Bass, Nithya Raman, Marquise Harris Dawson, Heidi Feldstein. So like, you know, and sure, there are people that like them and support them, but it's not this outpouring of love that you get. And I think that ethos that you were just explaining about, like, uplifting people that really had an impact to you and celebrating those around you that are able to support you is something that's important. And people, it resonates with people because community is what that it's about. And it's incredible that you're able to be, to build that. Talk about how that applies even in a position that is in theory black and white and numbers and so exact and, you know, can be boring, you know, to most people. Yeah. Many people.
No, of course. And I feel like this is a position to be that is very useful to demystify a lot of things, right? Like growing up, you really don't know where your money is being spent. You really don't know what your government is doing.
Yeah.
And I look at like the people like me when I was growing, you know, now, you know, I just live in my life. I don't really know what's happening in government. I'm like, well, let me try to target these people. So they know what their government is doing. And that's why we do everything through like funny mediums, right? Of course, we still have our long page reports that are super serious. But if you really want to meet people where they are, you have to explain it to them or do things in a way that that makes sense or it's easy for them to understand. So we do, like I said, the bar charts, the funny dances, the TikToks to get that information to them because they're like, oh, okay, maybe that's why my streetlight is out or maybe that's why my sidewalk is messed up. And so I think this is that position to help folks like who were like me growing up who just didn't really know what was happening. And then it's by design because government wasn't made to let you know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And for me, I was like, nah, screw that. Like, let me use my skills to show what government is doing. I think that is why it's so much more difficult for politicians in local government to do things because they know that I will show what they're doing. And that's sort of my strongest power is my ability to expose stuff. And it's sort of a political liability now because if you see where the money's going or where it's not going, you know, even though I can't vote on an item or like make direct policy changes or to the budget, we make it so obvious that you can't ignore it. Like they have to address why they voted that way. Why did they increase this? Why did they decrease it? And at least that's the conversation that needs to be had.
That's how it's
versus not like just sitting back and government is just on status quo status, which is how it's always been.
And so important to the rest of us to see this and you're kind of peeling back the layer, opening the box and giving us, again, the transparency is what it comes down to. How much blowback and pushback have you faced with your social media approach? What have you sort of dealt with? Because it unorthodox, to say the least, is a great way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, all the time. I mean, you know, elected officials will literally like subtweet me in real life. They'll be like, well, we shouldn't be using Twitter to talk about things, folks. And like, I was like, I know who they're talking about. Yeah. Like, we shouldn't be using TikTok. And I'm like, oh, he's talking about me. but I, you know, I disagree. I think it's, our biggest like reach is actually social media and that, you know, we use social media. I grew up with it and like we get millions of views and engagement like every month or so. And it's more than I would get if I, you know, were on the news.
Listen, or like you're in an article. Social media star. Like I'm not putting you in that box, but for any politician, that's what they dream, whether or not they say it, that's what they dream of right now is to have that kind of platform. And so go on.
And so, you know, I still do the art, you know, interviews, LA Times, go on the news here and then, but me disseminating information to people in my own way
is
like the best thing that could ever happen for my position and for me, because I never felt like the news could do me justice or an LA Times reporter could do me justice. Like people need to hear me, see me and feel me. Yeah. And that's sort of what we do with all of our posts and everything. And they could see that through me. And, you know, I do get blowback. It, 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 just in my, not just through social media, but just me doing my job, like having to expose things, you know, getting a lot of pressure from people to audit certain programs, homelessness, police, everything, right? Like not everyone in elected office is going to agree with that, right? And that could lead to actual consequences for me and my office, which, you know, I believe to this day, you know, when we got our budget cut, you know, was because of the stuff that we were doing, and trying to and provide transparency and accountability on certain things. And so, you know, it's tough, and that's why we're fighting for charter reform to be able to shield our budget, to make it an independent budget. So that way I can actually be the independent watchdog without having to rely on, you know, the council or the mayor. And it only makes sense, right? It's like, how are you going to vote for an elected official to be the independent watchdog? And they have to audit all the, you know, the council or the mayor's programs and departments that they like. And if they don't like the results, or, you know, or when we find out something, they get to decide what my budget is. You know, it just doesn't make sense. And so we're fighting for an independent budget through charter reform and just the ability to clarify my audit powers as well.
Is that one of your main focuses right now?
Yeah. And I would say main focus is right now and going to term two. I think, you know, the first term, we really are seeing how government works or how it doesn't work. Yeah. And as we finish our first, you know, term here, we had this opportunity through charter reform to change the constitution of LA, basically, to make it better, right? Whether it's expanding council sizes or giving the controller an independent budget or, you know, police reform or anything, like this is a perfect opportunity right now for Angelenos to get involved in making their government better. And so, you know, that's like one of the big things I'm excited for. If, you know, if we win going to our second term is really using these powers for good and what people voted for.
Charter reform is something that's been on the agenda for, honestly, as long as I can. I was actually doing some research on a Tom Bradley story. And Tom, so even when Tom Bradley was mayor, you know, that was an issue. So 40 years ago, is that something that, it, just explain like how that could even work and in a nutshell, in a Kenneth Mejia type of way, simplify that whole process and what that really means for us.
Sure. You know, the best, you know, comparison is think about it as the U.S. Constitution.
Okay.
But it's the L.A. Constitution. So all power is derived from the Constitution. And so the charter hasn't been changed in over 20 years. And so we have the opportunity now and people are going to vote on it this election in June. Possibly November as well, for changes to the charter that will create the system that we live in Los Angeles. And so I think this is really important for folks to really pay attention to and get involved and reach out to their council member, because the council member will the council members will decide what they want on there. So it's political as well. But yeah, we have great opportunity now to change the system. Like I said, for me to make the controller's powers, you know, more solidified, be a real true independent watchdog, have an independent budget, not, you know, prone to retaliation by elected officials or anything, so I could do my job. You know, those are just some of the great examples that we're seeing now. Expansion of council, ranked choice voting,
there we go.
You know, things like that. So it's really important.
That's interesting. Now, let's go back a little bit. Before you were elected controller, you had run for, you were part of the Koreatown Neighborhood Council?
Yeah, Koreatown, yep.
And you had run for office previously.
Sure.
Correct? So you have been running sort of these grassroots campaigns for probably more than a decade. When was the first time you were? Tell us about how you went from Ernest and Young to being a politician, whether or not, you know.
Yeah. So I would say, you know, back in even before that, like born and raised, you know, my single mom, she actually got me a lot into helping others too.
Nurses are the best people. My mom was a nurse.
Homelessness, helping with that. Like she would take me around and buy me food to give out to folks on the street. I forgot to mention this, but I grew up in a very strong Catholic like household as well. Okay. And so it's like, you know, treat others with compassion and, you know, that's how I do a lot. And so once I graduated college, I got in an EY, was an auditor, got my CPA, and then I left and worked private in the private sector, worked at a hedge fund, worked at a startup, worked at a, worked at some big public companies. So like I went like through like the whole typical, you know, golden accountant, you know, just doing your typical thing. And it was at the age of 25 that I really started getting into politics. Before that, like, I didn't care. So for folks listening, I'm 10 years older than 25 now. So, you know, I've been doing this for 10 years. Yeah. So at 25, I think it was 2015, I saw Bernie Sanders, like, on social media, on Facebook. And I was like, huh, you know, I'm, like, partying in Vegas and just, like, bottle service, right? Like, Cascade. Living on my, you know, six-figure salary and all that stuff. And I was like, whoa, there's actually someone here who actually cares about people. Like, he actually cares about people. You know, and everyone around me was like, nah, man, we're here partying, having a good time. Like, don't worry about that. And I was like, no, no, no. And then it sort of gave me flashbacks of, like, he was talking about people who I grew up with, you know, the parents, like my mom, and wanting to help them and giving them the opportunity and saying that, you know, things are the way they are because of your government or by the way the system is. And then, you know, that really resonated with me. And I always thought politicians were corrupt. Okay. And I thought, like, nothing could get done. Like, yeah. I thought, you know, no matter who is in power, one thing they all have in common is they want whoever has the most money and resources always wins. Yeah. And I was like, that's, you know, and I saw that, like, growing up, because I would travel. Like, once I had a good job, I'd be able to do all this stuff. And I thought to myself, well, I want everyone else to live this life. Yeah. I want everyone else to travel, come out with their family, go here and there. And I'll never forget, but it was and people can resonate with this with me too. But once they, like, see a politician that they resonate with, like, their whole life changes. Like they go from 0 to 100 real quick. So I remember I see Bernie Sanders is going to be in San Diego. Yeah. And I was working at
do you remember that first moment? Like, what was that Bernie moment?
It was like a rally that he did. And I was watching it on Facebook. And I was just really, like, inspired. Like, he was talking about the working class and what do you call it? He always knows for this word, but something about systemic inequality or socioeconomic inequality. I don't know, something. Yeah. And it just resonated. And I was like, this guy makes sense. So then I see him. He's in San Diego, right? Yeah. So this is literally like a week before I discover it. And I go to my boss and I'm like, hey, I'm really inspired by this guy named Bernie Sanders, you know? And, you know, hedge funds don't give a crap about stuff. And I'm like, hey, but I'm really inspired. I want to go see him. I want to see this guy. And he's like, fine, go ahead. So he gives me the day off tomorrow. I wake up at 5 a.m. to go to San Diego Convention Center. I'm the first in line.
All right.
To be there. And then I wait till I'm there at like 7 a.m. And then I'm right in front of him at 8 p.m. when he speaks. So for 13 hours, I'm waiting in line, not using the bathroom. But that's how, like, dedicated I was. I was on the news. There was actually a clip of me. They spelled my name wrong. you know, and I was just like, yeah, I'm really excited about this. It came out from L.A. And then, you know, I saw him. And then that really changed, like, you know, just seeing the amount of people. Because that also is infectious, too. Just seeing, like, tens of thousands of people. I was like, I'm not the only one. You know, and everyone had the same story about how they are not politically activated. And so from there, and then I found out he's going to be at the Wiltern like 2 days later. I was like, damn, because I went all the way to San Diego. And then the craziest thing happened, like 2 weeks later, you know, literally like, or like a few months later, I was like, all right, I'm going to quit my job. I'm going to run for Congress.
Come on.
Yeah. So I'm 25 years old, right? And I have the best job and I'm like making good money, living the good, like, private capitalist life, all that stuff, whatever, partying it up. And I was like, all right, hey boss, I'm gonna quit. And I was like, what? And then like I quit, and then I didn't even realize that I couldn't make the ballot anymore. So I ran as a write-in. Wow. And so I was like, I wouldn't advise.
Wait, what were you running for? Sorry, what position?
Congress. Okay. It was Congress.
Damn, yeah,
I went for Congress. Yeah, and I was like
starting small.
I was I went straight to the top. I was like, we got to help Bernie, because if he wins, he's going to need people who are going to vote for him and write legislation and da, 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 da. And so I ran quit my job, six-figure job. I ran as a write-in, dumbest thing ever. Got 1,177 votes, which is great.
Badass.
Which is great for
badass
a write-in.
As a write-in,
got 0% in 2016. And then
but hold on. I want to know, how were you even campaigning? You're not even on the ballot.
Yeah,
like,
no.
Knocking on doors.
It was that whole Bernie, that whole Bernie Sanders wave. Like, there were rallies every week, every day. I would show up to it all. Right when I quit, I was like showing up to everywhere.
Were you self-funding as far as, like, promotional material, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Like my like people, yeah, we had a ton of volunteers too already because they felt it as well. You know?
It was a movement.
It was a movement at the time. And so in 2017, I ran a second time because the Congress member at the time got appointed to Attorney General.
Okay.
And so it was an open seat.
And by the way, you're living in Koreatown at this point?
Yeah, I'm in K-Town. Exactly.
I got to take a tangent. Just what brought you to K-Town and what are your thoughts on that neighborhood?
I love K-Town.
Yeah,
right? Like,
of course.
K-Town is the most dense neighborhood in L.A.
Absolutely.
Parking sucks. The food is great. The food is great.
Yep.
It's like one of the best like melting pots around here in L.A. But you know, I would always take a metro because K-Town is very metro heavy. So going up there, took metro a lot, but it was chill, especially like the nightlife. I would walk around Sixth Street a lot.
Fun.
So fun. Fun times.
Kind of one of the more urban areas of L.A., if you will. You know,
super.
Like
super
a neighborhood, dope. Still an L.A. neighborhood community, but you get the urban.
It's always happening though. Yeah, it's always popping there. So I was in K-Town. Yep.
So 2017, you're living in K-Town.
2017.
You had already ran as a write-in candidate,
clocking
more than 1,000 votes, which again, just very impressive.
Yeah.
And you want to do it again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so go.
So 1,200 write-in votes, I was like, that's pretty good. And so it was at the end of 2016, I also left the Democratic Party at that time because I saw like what they did to Bernie and, you know, I was very like, it sort of brought me back to where I was, like how I thought about the things. And I was like, I mean, I could just give up now. Or I was like, no. Let me try to do something new. I was like, we need something new.
Yeah.
We can't just have Democrat, Republican.
How did you not get discouraged? Because I know a lot of my friends that were Bernie supporters at the time.
It takes a lot.
Were like, the system is corrupt. This is exactly what I thought. Bernie has, this is corrupt. Hillary, blah, blah, blah.
Like, imagine if you were me, you quit your job, you quit everything. Like, everyone looks at you like you're like messed up. They would just go back to, you know, let me just go back to what I was doing.
Yeah.
But for me, I was like, nah, I gotta double down. I was like, I'm going in all the way. I actually believe in this. And so, you know, I registered green and I ran as a green third party in 2017.
Formally got on the ballot this time.
As a green, formally got on. We actually did really well. We basically like, there were like 20 candidates and we basically like tied with like fourth place with everyone. And then, we didn't make the primary, but then I ran again in 2018, which was my third time. And I was like, okay, at least this one, I have more time now. Because 2017, it was right after the general election and then in 2016 that you had to write away.
Yeah.
So 2018, I was like, okay, this is a real campaign now. Like, I actually have a year and a half to campaign. So I did it again, ran as a green, made it to the general election.
Wow.
I think I have the record right now for the highest vote percentage as a green against a Democrat in the country right now. And from there, you know, that's where I met my campaign manager, Jenk. She was also involved with advocacy. But, you know, I would just say about this movement, about this work, is you meet people along the way in all these different organizations and people who just care about like human rights and compassion and about really tackling systemic issues instead of just tackling symptoms, right? And so that's sort of this, we built this sort of infrastructure and movement in 2018 and we did well. And after that, like after I lost, I was like, okay, I've done this for a while. And I think it takes a lot of you personally.
Did
your
you
personal
consider yourself
life.
A politician at this point? You're like, I'm
no. I'm still the same, you know, wearing shorts, flip flops, even right now, I'm still wearing it. But I would say like I did that for hard, if you think about 2016 and 2018, like hardcore 3 years of just so much sacrifice, like my family, my friends, they saw this different side of me that they never see, you know, the clown, the partier, the person who just goes out all the time and is having a good time. And here, like they see me on the news, like shouting at like politicians and protesting. And so I would say those 3 years are super intense. And then after that, I was like, okay, I need to step back. And so from 2018 to 2020, I was like, I'm not really going to do much. Like, I'm just going to, you know, just help out, but not as much. And then George Floyd happened in 2020. And, you know, in Los Angeles, the Black Lives Matter LA movement, they were really focusing a lot on that budget at the time.
Right.
And they wanted to see more investment in, you know, in things that make community safe, not just policing, but, you know, in care and in infrastructure and things that make our environment, you know, safer and better for everyone. And, you know, I reached out to Jane because she was part of the People's Budget movement that was started by Black Lives Matter LA. And I said, hey, like, you know, maybe I could help out. I could give you guys, you know, use some of my CPA or accounting skills. And I thought it was perfect. And so we made bar charts and everything. And then from there, I reached out to, you know, Jane again. I was like, hey, why don't we, there's this position called controller. I don't know if you want me to talk about my journey now.
So
2020, you know, people were really putting like police budgets and how much money they get like in the spotlight throughout the country.
Yeah.
And people realize like, oh my God, it's a lot.
It's like first
over,
time. It's
over
first
$3 billion. Over
yeah.
$3 billion. It's, you know, half of our unrestricted funds, nearly half of our general fund revenues. And pretty much I reached out to Jane and I said, hey, like, why don't we, you know, I want to run for controller. It's the city's accountant auditor. No one knows about it. Right now, the only one running for it is this other politician, council member in the fifth district. And, you know, he already has all the endorsements. He's already lined up everyone, Democratic Party, everyone who's in office already, all the unions and everything. And
Rubber stamp.
Yeah. And I was just like, and then I looked into his background. I was like, 30 years as a politician, no accounting experience, no auditing. And it was funny because we had to do a questionnaire endorsement thing together. And it says, list the amount of years of accounting and auditing experience you have. And his says zero. And mine says like 10 years, right? And so Jane was like, yeah, sure. So, you know, I have to thank Jane because she pushed me as well. And then, you know, if she didn't do it, I'd be like, all right, I don't think I could do this. But she helped me with the graphics. She helped me with the messaging. She helped me with the strategy. And from there, we ran this campaign from 2020 to December 2020 is when we launched, all the way to June 2022. I was just like, let's just tell people where the money's going, where it's not going. Let's just put on all these graphics, these bar charts, these billboards, letting people know in an easy manner why the city is the way it is.
Yeah.
And that's how we did it. And, you know, we ran in a crowded field of like 9 candidates or 8 candidates. And leading up to the primary, we had no clue. We had no clue how we were going to do. Like, right. I thought we were going to lose because we had no support. Like, no one gave us a shot.
You were as grassroots as it could be.
Exactly.
You were a homegrown campaign doing something completely different in a position that had never seen anything remotely like the campaigning that you were doing. Yeah,
exactly. But luckily, we had the apparatus from previous elections and just people who saw what we were doing.
You had volunteers?
Yeah.
Where were you getting your budget? Were you getting donations? How was
a
all
lot
that
of
working?
Donations. Yeah. Literally, like, funded by small grassroots dollars. Even today, still funded by grassroots small dollar donations. You know, I would say, though, in 2020, right, like, it started this whole progressive movement, right? Yep. It started with Nithya Raman, like, Raman a little bit, like, just in more contemporary ages, like, her in 2020 winning, and then 2022 was at Unisys, Ugo, and then me, and then 2024 was Isabel. But I would say for my election, though, like, we didn't have a lot of support. Like, we ran without the support of the Democratic establishment. We tried. We did all the questionnaires. We did everything. We tried to show them that, like, experience and qualifications matter more than a D next to your name. And people resonated with that. And we ended up, like, when we won the primary, I was so shocked. I didn't even know what, I was like, oh my God, this is about to happen. Like, we're about to be the controller. Cause I knew if we won in June, we would win in November.
Yeah.
And we actually won almost 50% in June.
Do you remember the number?
What it was like 45% or something.
So at that point, they picked the top two, right?
Right. And then the other person was like 25%.
Wow.
So I knew from there, I was like, all right, let's just kill it. Let's just keep doing
it. But how did you, I mean, again, it's still phenomenal. Yeah. To get to that point from not even internally thinking that you're like, oh, we got a shot here, you know, let's just keep, I mean, obviously you're going to keep pushing, but you weren't like, oh, we're one of the top ones. You were just like,
I was scared. Like,
blind.
I thought, you know, no, the thing that was super scary is we had hundreds of volunteers and so many people believing in us. And I was scared we were going to let them down, like, in June. But, you know, what's interesting now that I look back is, like, we were getting a lot of hit pieces, like LA Times, a lot of reporters were just writing garbage articles, talking crap about us. And I was like, wow, why are they going after me so hard? And it didn't hit to me that what I learned in the political world is they do that because either internal polling shows you're doing good or, like, you're going to make an upset.
You're a threat. You were a threat.
I didn't think about it like that. I was actually, I was like, man. And so that even made me more scared for Junior. I was like, man, they're taking out of these things out of context. They're attacking me. They're, you know, and so when we won, it was surreal. And I'll never forget that. They were like in Highland Park at the pretty much just, you know, have our crew were there, all our people. And we were just like, oh my God, I can't believe it. It was like the most genuine, like shouting and like yelling and sighs of relief that we had. We were also doing a documentary with Snapchat too, so that was fun. But it was just, you know, it was really a true testament of meeting people where they are and being an honest, you know, person, just meeting, you know, talking about the issues that people really care about and not just talking to them on what, you know, we want them to hear, but actually listening to them and telling them why things are the way they are and showing them where the money's going. That's what resonated with folks. And that's why we ended up, you know, getting 513,000 votes in the general, which is more than, you know, the mayor or anyone else. And so.
What was your percentage? Do you remember in the general?
In the general, like 64% or something.
Incredible.
Like,
some crimes are so shocking, they don't just make headlines. They forever change our society. I'm Katie Ring, host of America's Most Infamous Crimes. Each week, I take on one of the most notorious criminal cases. Each case unfolds across multiple episodes, released every Tuesday through Thursday, from the first sign that something was wrong to the moment the truth came out or didn't. Listen to and follow America's Most Infamous Crimes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Now, one of your main like planks for your platform was, I don't want to say defunding the police, but I'm trying to say this carefully. You know, it can be interpreted as anti-police sentiment,
right?
Talk to me about that or where you stand. And I know that there was definitely that groundswell, like you said, in the aftermath of George Floyd and just everything that's going on, everything that's been going on for decades, you know. But so tell me where that comes from and how people reacted to that.
Yeah. You know, and I would say growing up too, like we had DARE, we had LAPD show up, you know, to our schools and everything. And, you know, you're like, oh yeah, maybe one day I want to be a police officer. And it wasn't until like I got older that, you know, cameras started showing what was happening.
Yeah.
You know, and I would see these things like, oh, why is this guy getting like beat up more than necessary, or excessively, or sometimes even getting killed.
Of course.
And, you know, that shaped a lot on how, you know, I saw things. I was like, this is not right. Like, this is government. This is actually government. And what is government doing about it?
Yeah.
And so for me, like when I ran, you know, even right now in office, I haven't even said defund the police or anything. What I feel is that police needs to be more transparent and they need to be more accountable. When things happen out there, whether it's like these protests in ICE and you see someone getting like shot at with a less lethal in the face or in, you know, a reporter or anything, you just got to wonder like, why? Like, why is that happening?
Yeah.
If we're going to give the department $3.4 billion, at least let's know what we're getting out of it. And that's sort of how I've led with things is like, let's just show where the money goes for, especially for police. It's the highest spend. And if we're going to keep spending on them, let's at least get them to be, getting them to put more data. Like, recently, there's actually less data and less transparency. Like, we're not seeing as much now, like, on arrest data, on crime data.
They're really trumpeting the low homicide totals, though.
Like if you, right, and if you think about it, like, the low homicides, they're at the lowest number of police officers right now.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, okay, so actually crime is down, and we're at the lowest of where it's ever been in the police department. But the budget's just astronomically even higher than it was like, you know, back then. And they had more police officers, you know, back then. It goes to show like, well, how is safety, you know, reflected? Is it just police? Is it community care? Is it unarmed response? Is it giving people, you know, better, you know, public works, infrastructure, parks, playgrounds, you know, bridges, all that?
All of that.
And so, you know, what I tried to do with police is just show where the money goes and how it's being used, right? And from there, it's people can then make their own judgment, right? But that's how I've always felt about the police is they need to be more transparent And there needs to be some accountability as well when bad things happen, right? And yeah. I think right now, the transparency part, we're trying to help with that. But the accountability part, I don't think a lot of people are seeing any of that. And, I've communicated that with folks that's why people have this sort of reaction on, law enforcement. They just need to see whether it's ICE, whether it's LAPD. If they see someone with a gun and a badge doing something to somebody that like looks just terribly. And it doesn't help when these agencies go like, well, you guys don't know. We're in law enforcement. We've been doing this for like, this is the way it is. And we're actually the best of the best. And I'm like, oh, if this is the best of the best of shooting like a protester in the stomach who poses no harm, who's standing right in front of you. There's that one video from June where this protester was trying to walk home in Little Tokyo and the police just shot her in the stomach and she posed no harm. And it's just like, well, why did we do that? And people have eyes.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's what I want. Like, I want a government that is more transparent, but also accountable when we screw up. And then I think that will go a long way in building better relationships, and that's sort of how I've led, is just showing what it is and trying to get the department to be just more accountable and more transparent on why they do things.
It's really articulate. Listen, I've been, assailed for my stance on the police. Mm-hmm. We have a cousin who's a police officer, and I've been supportive of mm-hmm. LAPD. I'll just come out and say it. But at the same time, my dad, he was an old hippie from way back. When he passed away, we found a list in his backpack of every victim of, police brutality.
Right.
And he had these lists, and things like that, where it was just pretty, it even resonated with him. Cause I remember him telling me, he was like, it was different when I was a kid, where he's like, you'd see police in the neighborhood, in the community, walking on the street, shaking hands, playing ball, like, where he's like, people actually used to look up to police officers because it was different. It wasn't, you didn't only see them when it was bad news. You didn't only see them when they were, doing something nefarious or something that, got these negative ramifications. And somewhere along the line, the Daryl Gates era, well, LAPD has kind of a bad history, but Daryl Gates, obviously Rodney King, and it just continued to keep happening. And then reputationally, it turned into something where the sentiment really turned against the LAPD. But to your point, if there were more accountability and more just maybe owning up to these mistakes or these bad actors in the department, it could really go a long way. Because I do believe, for me personally, that we need a strong force, at least strong might be the wrong word. We need the ability to have people to enforce laws and quote unquote fight the bad guys. I know that's very simple. You can't have no police, but at the same time, you can't have this society where people are afraid of the police and people don't want to call the police because it's going to end up bad no matter what. There needs to be some sort of different approach. I do appreciate, what you've done with the, at least trying to hold them accountable in that regard, and just comes down to transparency, which is what you've been about.
And I'll just say one last thing on that is the reason from a finance accounting perspective on why we have to provide transparency on them is because they take the biggest chunk of the budget.
Yeah.
So from a financial accounting material standpoint, there needs to be transparency on that. And when bad things happen from them, it leads to these massive liability payouts that is, right now, and people know we're in a budget deficit, and liability payouts are one of the biggest reasons why the city is underwater.
Man, that's incredible. And every time I see those, that makes my blood boil.
You spent over $1 billion in 6 years on like liability payouts. So that's why we focus hard on it. And 400 million of that is, police.
Man. And I know, I want to be respectful of your time, so I do want to start wrapping up, but a few more questions.
Sure.
What are your goals for the city vis-a-vis your position as controller? Like what in your, let's say in your second term, knock on wood for you, what would you want to accomplish? What can you accomplish?
Yeah. I mean, for my second term, my second term is I really want to continue with a stronger support for my office.
Yeah.
My office is actually at the most interesting thing is my office staff is at the lowest that like basically it's been in like history, but we are so good at what we do on making information known.
You're efficient. Yeah.
Like you know, that comes to the fact that we have a good team of people who have done this work, right? They work in finance. I work in finance. We have people who work in homelessness. We have people who work in criminal justice reform, things like that. And so we're able to just make the controller's office really powerful, even though we have the lowest amount of people due to budget cuts, right? And so I would say for second term is just continuing on that, like letting elected officials continue to see the work that we do more as an assistance or, you know, advocacy efforts to what they want to do and not more of like, you know, them being afraid of me or being like, you know, a council member told me this. He said, it's, you know, what I've told people is it's actually, you want to include Kenneth in the conversation and, you know, shout out to McOsker. Tim McOsker.
Yeah,
you know,
we don't agree on it.
We don't agree on everything, right? Like that's a good example. Like he, you know, he worked for, for the Police Protective League, and we're opposite on some things, but he's been one of the greatest allies that I've had. And I think that's what a lot of people, especially voters, have seen, that maturity, that this, oh, well, like, wow, we might not agree on this, but actually they get a lot done together on, and we all agree on transparency and accountability. So I say second term, charter reform is what we're focused on. Yeah. Hopefully we get that independent budget. Hopefully we get more resources to do more audits, more fraud, waste, and abuse investigations. I don't know if people know, but 3 weeks ago, some, you know, our fraud, waste, and abuse investigators basically led to someone getting arrested for fraudulently obtaining $23 million. It was a homeless service provider. Wow. So that was on the news. So people check that out. So I'd love to have more resources for that.
Yeah.
And my second term, because we get over 700 claims of fraud, waste, and abuse. And I only have 5 investigators to do that work.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And so it's that small.
Exactly. And I only have 7 auditors to do audits. So I can only do 2 to 3 audits a year. And that's why I said at the very beginning of this, like the audits and the oversight work gets the most attention.
Yeah.
But it's my smallest group. And it's because of me and our executive team that we're able to be so loud and about everything in government. That's why we look like we're doing a lot.
Right.
But in reality, like the hard hitting investigations, the audits, I need more teams. So I'm looking towards, you know, more staff for that, in the next term and just, you know, continuing to work with other city officials. Cause I think right now, I would say the first couple of years or the first 2 years, it was difficult. But now a lot of elected officials are actually listening to our recommendations. They're fixing the budget based on what we've been doing. And it's because we've known, we always knew the numbers don't lie, yeah. Right? Like the numbers say the truth. And now they're actually using our recommendations, pushing, want to work with us with our audits. You know, they're budgeting better. And, you know, maybe because an election season's happening right now. But I would say they're working with us, right? Because a lot of the misconception is, oh my God, Kenneth doesn't collaborate with people. But what I realize is like a lot of them are actually working with us now because what is so obvious and out there is they have to fix it, you know, and I'm not going to just hide things. Like that's why I love my job being independent. And also why I don't need to be a Democrat or a Republican is because people want someone who's going to go in there and who's not going to, you know, chummy it up with other elected officials, but show like what's happening in your government. Provide recommendations and get LA on the right path. So I would say that's what I'm looking forward to, systemic reform through charter reform and just continuing to hold City Hall accountable.
Tell me, you said LA on the right path. What does that mean to you? What is your vision for the city of Los Angeles, say, in 2036?
Yeah, you know, so right now the city is not on a good path financially, because I'm talking from a financial perspective. Yeah.
Talk about that deficit real quick.
What's the number? So, you know, we've just finished the second year of budget deficits in a row.
Yeah.
You know, the city budgets too high of a revenue amount and we don't hit it. And I warned them. I said, hey, you budget too high, you're going to have a deficit. Because what the city does is when they budget high, they'll try to spend to that number.
Of course.
And if they don't do it, what they'll end up doing is they will freeze that department's operations. Like they're hiring and they're already short staffed.
Yeah.
Like their expenses and, you know, they can't even do their job anymore. So we have this deficit of less revenue, but also over expenditures, plus these massive liability payouts that's just ruining us. And so
what's the number, the deficit number for 20?
I mean, last fiscal, we had to close like a nearly $1 billion one. Right now, we have some over expenditures right now, over 200 million.
Yeah.
Revenues are like stable right now. So we'll see how it ends up going. But if the over expenditures exceed the revenues, then we'll be in deficit again. Yes. And we'll know more because the budget drops on April 20th, how we're going to end up. But, you know, it's not looking good. But also, I would just say financially, what the city's trying to do with the revenue piece is they're looking to raise fees or taxes, right? And in my opinion, I think it makes sense for fees that weren't raised like 40 years ago, right?
Yeah.
But if we're just raising taxes just to like cover all this spending with no oversight, I think, especially with no proportional increase in, you know, our auditors or accountants to do that independent oversight, I think it's a wrong decision. Because if you're going to increase taxes and fees, at least hire more independent people to oversee that.
Yeah.
And that's what I tell folks, or at least show people like where it's going. And that's what I've been trying to do, is show where if you increase all these fees in the general fund, it's just going to go to this pie chart right here, this XYZ, where it's going to go. And it's just going to continue. Right. So, you know, but I would say in 10 years or so, you know, I'm hoping soon that the city can just cover the basics, like keep the streetlights on, trim the trees, fix the sidewalks, fix the potholes, have more parks, have more green space. And I think if you build a city that covers those basics and have that infrastructure in place, you'll have a safer city. You'll have a happier city. Yeah. You'll have Angelenos who actually care about, you know, making their communities better. But if we're just, you know, giving money to a lot of reactive things, right, or giving, you know, half of our discretionary funds to police to tackle all these issues that come from the fact that there are no opportunities to live in a better neighborhood that has, you know, better, you know, light streets, sidewalks, everything, then it will just continue with the same path forward. The city is going to be using the Olympics a lot as a reason to do a lot of this stuff. But if we didn't have the Olympics, where would we be, right? Like, we have to truly care about wanting to make our city a great and better and safer city without using an event, right?
Right.
Because after the Olympics is done, then what, you know? Sure. And what people don't know is, well, the city of LA taxpayers are on the hook if there are any cost overruns, you know? Yeah. And so
a lot about that.
So I'm hopeful, but if we could get back to the basics and just getting things done, like just taking care of, you know, our city, I think that will go a long way in having a better city. Yeah.
That's a great answer. Okay. Two last questions.
Sure.
Let's say second term goes well. What's the big picture? What's the big picture for Kenneth Mejia in the future?
You know, I was making a, okay, I'm not going to say that. But you know, I would say do one more term, because I really love this job.
Yeah, like,
If I could be the controller, accountant, auditor forever, I would. Because this is my like bread and butter is numbers. And I could show it like just in good, great ways to people. So I would love to be controller forever, but I can't. But after my second term, we'll see. You know, I don't, everyone thought I was going to run for mayor like this time. I heard we did actually pretty well in some polling, like for mayor for this election.
You're a good name.
And when I saw that, I was like, okay, I need to run. I need to announce for controller, because I can't have this like, because there was paranoia happening. Like, there was a lot of paranoia happening. And so, so we'll see. We'll see what happens in the second term. I take everything like day by day.
But you have too much passion, exuberance, energy, focus, belief. There's definitely something bigger and better in the future. Okay. Now to close out, let's talk about your Los Angeles. All right. Mm-hmm. When you're not doing your audits, when you're not doing your transparent reports, when you're not working with your team to put out this awesome, incredible, informative content on social media, where do you hang out? What neighborhoods do you love? What's a day or a weekend in the life of Kenneth Mejia?
Yeah. So, you know, now, like, I love walking, like, with my dogs in, like, green space. So, parks. I love going to different parks throughout Los Angeles. Vista Hermosa and Hi-Fi out there. Just pretty much like anything where like there's, you know, we don't have a lot of light at night, but cause I finished late working, but just anywhere where I could walk, Albion Riverside Park, that's in Lincoln Heights. I love that park too. Now I'm telling everyone where my parks are. Everyone's going to find me there. No, I'm just kidding. But you know, people, they usually notice me, when I have two corgis like walking. So I love the dogs.
Yeah.
They're the watchdogs. That's how they relate to my office. I love eating. I love, you know, I recommend for folks, check out, if you like to try Filipino street food, go to Dollar Hits. They're super dope. But yeah,
How come Filipino food hasn't had that wave in Los Angeles, man? Like, you know, all that. Like, I know that there's some great chefs out there doing it, but why hasn't it just sort of blown up?
You know, I love Filipino food. That's my favorite. And if anyone wants to try something, my favorite Filipino dish is called sinigang, and it's I like it very sour. But you know, Filipino food is like an acquired taste. You have to just grow up with it and everything. But
I don't know.
But when you go there, I think it's because Filipino dishes are served in large servings, like in big bowls or trays. So for you know Americans or for people, they might like not see that as you know, appetizing. They might feel like it might not even be the best thing to eat. And so they look at, you know, the different foods and they're like, that doesn't look for me. But, when you try it, you know, it's actually really delicious. I would say people start off with Filipino food, start with, adobo, lumpia, egg rolls, then pancit, which is the noodles. Start off with that. And then once you get into it more, then go to sinigang and all these different other ones. But, you know, or do Filipino breakfast. It's basically rice, spam, and eggs. And then Filipinos sometimes eat it with ketchup. And then you eat it all of it together. But that's like the most basic one. Yeah.
Man, that's right up my alley. Well, that was awesome. We could talk all day, but I know you got some transparency to show to the rest of us in Los Angeles. So we're seeing how things really work. I want to say, look, man, again, politically, I was like, maybe we didn't see eye to eye, but with all the information you've been conveying, you're not just somebody who's taking these stances because you want to be wild or crazy. Right. Like there's rationale behind it, and you're enlightening all of us, and you're showing us this great information on how our city really operates in a position that I hadn't known anything about, and now you're making that high profile, and it's really important. And honestly, keep doing what you're doing. I appreciate you, and I appreciate what you're doing for the city of Los Angeles. So thank you.
Thank you, Evan. Thank you.
And thank you so much for being here. LA City Controller, Kenneth Mejia, getting it done. Transparency for the city of Los Angeles. All right, LA, it's been a minute.
I'm Sarah Austin Jeunesse, The Moth's executive producer and longtime host of The Moth Podcast. Every week, we share true stories told live and without notes by real people from all walks of life. Stories about disastrous haircuts, May-December romances, photographing Pluto, fighting for justice, and so much more. Some stories make you laugh, some make you think, and many stay with you long after they're told. Discover the power of story. Follow and listen to The Moth wherever you get your podcasts.